Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
USDA is working on a bunch of programs to basically help expand meat and poultry processing capacity in the United States. We know that it's very consolidated and concentrated, and we want to have more options for farmers.
USDA's Deputy Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, Mei Wu.
And what we're talking about is the technical assistance that we have brought in to help grant applicants and projects get off the ground and get across the finish line. Flower Hill does serve as kind of the hub for our networks, but we do have a lot of groups that are also part of it. We've got the Oregon State University Niche Meat Processors Assistance Network, or NPAM. We've got the Intertribal Agriculture Council. We've got the American Meat Science Association, the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, and the American Association of Meat Processors all signed up and all part of this big, huge network that we have of providers.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
From the export side, sales have generally been good. China's been a big part of that. You know, China's come back in the game here for the past couple of crop years, which is great.
That's John Devine. He's senior economist with Cotton Incorporated.
Consumer demand here in the U.S. is strong, so that helps in the closing, the downstream pull that we feel in the fiber market. But, the big issue on the export side, of course, is shipments. You talk to the cotton merchants, they say, they'll tell you they've been struggling with logistical issues this whole year due to, problems with trucking, problems with trying to find space on boats, trying to find containers. It's been a whole range of issues. And even though sales have been strong and demand has been relatively solid, our shipments this year are down about 35% year over year. They're still hoping that we'll be able to catch up, but otherwise, we could be left potentially with some additional stocks in our warehouses. Normally, that could mean downward pressure on prices, but we are not in normal times. With the shipping crisis, if we're unable to ship, I think that's an indication of scarcity rather than a surplus, and that could be a factor that has been supporting prices.
And Devine also reminds us that consumer demand has been good as well.
So I think one thing that's important to think about over the past couple of years or year or two is that the U.S. consumer has been showing up in a big way. Take a look at consumer spending on apparel. It's up 25% compared to same months back in 2019. So compared against pre-COVID, we're up a quarter. Consumers are buying one quarter more clothing than they did back then. Nominal rates of growth are around 2%. So we've had very outsized growth in terms of consumer demand for clothing. Other places around the world haven't been quite as robust as us in terms of their growth in clothing spending, but refilling of pipelines after the recession has also been a contributor to strength in demand. And while all of that has been very good, I think we also need to be a little bit cautious in terms of what might be coming down the pipe. We had record monthly increases in energy prices here over the past few months. That's going to pinch consumers, of course, here in the U.S., but also around the world. Food prices have been increasing dramatically as well. You take a look at food and energy. These are necessities. So the increased spending on necessities due to the increase in prices may pinch consumer clothing demand. And also, since demand has been so strong too, there could be some leveling off that also could turn into a little bit of a headwind as we get further down the road.
But with prices well above a dollar, there is some concern about demand destruction.
Something that we've been watching and that we're paying close attention to in our discussions, particularly with retailers and folks on the buying end of the supply chain, is, what are they doing with these high cotton prices? Last time we went through this 10 years ago, the big issue for us was the loss in share. We lost about 10 percentage points here in the U.S., apparel market to competing fibers. There is some concern about that this time around. But what we've been hearing from folks on the downstream end of the supply chain is that we haven't been hearing the same switching that we did about a decade ago. So I think that's something to be encouraged about. I think the arguments that cotton has on the sustainability front are resonating around the microfiber issue. And also around the fact that cotton truly is circular. Talking about dirt to shirt, and we can go back to dirt again if we need to. So I think something else we're watching, of course, is cotton share. And I think there's reason to be more positive about that than we were 10 years ago.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Revenue is price times quantity. You have a lot of control over quantity because of how you manage the agronomics of the farm.
Danny Morris is an ag economist at the University of Tennessee at Martin.
And one thing I would challenge you on the price, yes, I can't call up Chicago Mercantile Exchange and say, I don't like the price you gave me today, I want you to change it. I can't do that.
If you figure out how to do that, please let me know.
Right. But what I can do is I can determine when do I sell my crop. I can put in storage. I can buy myself time, get past that seasonal low, and sell it then. I can put in a bag. I can put in a dryer, harvest sooner. There's a lot of things we can do on the production side that has an impact on when we have to physically sell it. Now, the marketing side, just like today, you know, wheat prices. I looked at our futures back home. Wheat prices are, of course, everybody. The wheat futures are off the market because of what's going on with Ukraine. Right now, a good strategy would be, let's do an HTA. Let's lock in those futures because our basis back home is $1.75 under. Who wants that basis? Nobody wants that basis. Buy yourself some time. So, you know, and that was one thing. That's what I did right out of school is I worked for ADM Grain as a grain merchandiser. And you learn about all those different contracts that you can offer your producers to help them with those things. You can do options. You can do futures for contracts. So I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm just thinking that producers have some way to mitigate volatile commodity prices. And if they have risk management tools, utilize them.
Speaking recently at Commodity Classic, was asked what he's most excited about today.
For me, it's prices. I know input costs have gone up so much. Really and truly, the only godsend we've had has been the increase in commodity prices. I think that gives a lot of producers an opportunity to stay in the black. As long as they're aggressive in their marketing, and I know it's very nerve-wracking to market too much of your crop before you get the first seed in the ground, but it's also as quick as it came, it can go as quick as well. And I would be fearful as we get into the growing season and we see that we might have a good crop, what that could do to commodity prices. Of course, there's a lot of things going on across the globe that we don't know what's going to impact prices, particularly if it impacts export markets. But I think for us going into a year, it's been so doom and gloom with input prices being so high, particularly fertility, you know, increasing over 200% on all N, P, and K, that gives a little light at the end of the tunnel. And I like to look, you know, for the positive as much as I can, and that's been a positive. So that is exciting.
David Widmar is an ag economist with Agricultural Economic Insights.
Well, I've been using the phrase cautiously optimistic to think about 2022. 2021 was a phenomenal year, especially for raising corn and soybeans, and you had decent yields. It's equivalent to hitting a grand slam. And so you had the basis loaded with a low cost structure, and you had good yields, and you had a phenomenal price. And so a lot of profitability there, a lot of improvement in the balance sheet took place. I think all farmers were able to breathe a sigh of relief. Lenders are able to breathe a sigh of relief as well. The whole sector sort of got healed up. Now, as you think about 2022, it's kind of like the guy who's got to go hit after your teammate just hit the grand slam. It's very unlikely that you're going to be able to score 4 points. But you got to focus on getting a base hit. And I think 2022 is going to be one of those years, despite the high cost structure, which is a challenge. It adds a lot of risk to the sector. Producers are looking at a budget scenario that has some economic returns in there, probably more favorable economic returns than we saw between 2014 and 2020 in the budgeting scenario. So relative to last year, we're in the shadow of a really great year, but in the grand scheme of our careers, we could probably still make progress towards our goals. We can build our equity, and we can start to make plans for how do we want to grow the operation moving forward. So that's what I'm excited about, is helping producers maybe shore up some profitability here and make some plans for the future.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Overall, flat to slightly up across wheat class, depending on where we'd be calling the market. Let's just do the cash market first. AMS called the Fed cattle at about 140, 141 a couple times here for Kansas. It's a little higher than that in the Nebraska area, 144. One of them I wrote down is 145 as elite closed. That's a little bit stronger than on the board. So April live cattle was 142. That was up about $2 for the week. We flip over to feeder cattle. The Pratt market on Thursday was $2 to $4. There's a couple lots that were every bit of $5 higher. Not a lot of volume, which isn't necessarily surprising, but the two lots I wrote down for context is one lightweight 400-pound lot, 88 head, sold for $232. We definitely weren't talking those prices a couple years ago, so why bring it in? That was one of the larger lightweight lots, so I'll share that. And then on the higher end, a lot of 62 head weighing $693, sold for $172. Those, again, would be a little bit higher than the week before. We look at the board, April feeder cattle is 158, flat from the week before. add into this, the cutout, choice cutout, closed the book on Thursday, that was 270. It was down about $2 the week before. Similar, select was down about $4 on the week. And my last comment, just to kind of round out, you know, how the week went, was the system was full. So processing initial estimates through Saturday were 665,000 head. That's exactly what it was a year ago for the same week. That's a full 30,000 head ahead of where it was the week before. So year-to-date cattle slaughters up about 0.5%. I think we'll see. Now, I have been saying this for like 2 months. We got to be getting close to where we're going to see that to start to taper off some. This will lead into the cattle on feed report a little bit, but the year's sort of front-loaded. The year has been full. And as we're going to talk about here in the cattle on feed report, there's more animals in the yard per that report than some are thinking.
Now, USDA out on Friday with the latest cattle on feed report, a bearish report.
So in the near term, it would definitely be bearish for live cattle prices, to be clear here. So anything in the next, you know, 3 to 6 months, you know, this report is not optimistic for that. But underneath this, I think, is some examples of cattle being pulled forward for various reasons. A lot of that's probably a combination of weather and feed cost and so forth, not just in the feed yard, but on the home ranch are all part of this. You know, the markets are working there. Thinking through that is, I do think this is bearish in the near term, but it may not necessarily be bearish when we look out, you know, 8, 9, you know, even 12 months from now. That doesn't help anybody that's got cattle in the feed yard right now. I'm well aware of that. But in a repeat game, so to speak, this does set the stage for, I think, a much tighter supply story forward throughout 2022 and certainly into 2023. The other level of this is, you know, Kansas specifically, mm-hmm. Yes. It does stand out a little bit in this report. So everything I've talked about so far is the national numbers, but things like basis patterns and so forth become region specific pretty fast. So what was Kansas compared to the other two largest states? Nebraska and Texas is the what I want to walk our listeners through. Mm-hmm. We start April 1st in Kansas up 1% on inventories. That's actually a little smaller than Nebraska and Texas were up 3%. Okay, so there's one distinction. But the real distinction for Kansas is the March placements and marketings numbers. March placements and March marketings were larger in Kansas than they were either Texas or Nebraska. And we don't normally see that. I didn't go through the record books to see if it's happened before. It may well have happened before, but it's definitely not the norm. Texas and Nebraska typically have more animals in their feed yards than Kansas is part of that. So there's definitely a north to south difference going on here. Nebraska was 7% larger placements in March compared to a year earlier. Kansas was flat compared to a year earlier, and Texas was down 6%. When you look at the marketings in March, Nebraska was up 8%, Texas was down 9%. So there's a big difference between the states that are larger than Kansas, you know, north and south of here, Kansas falling in between. I think there's going to be a lot of chatter on this being a surprising report, and then the subsequent component of that's going to be notably distinct state-by-state differences that I think the market's going to take some time to absorb.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
As you look at the box beef trade, we're grinding higher, as you would expect as we're getting into that summer grilling.
Iowa State livestock economist Lee Schultz.
Choice select spread is getting wider as we're seeing kind of that switch to those types of cuts and why you're seeing the widening there. You know, I think we could easily push the 290 to 300 at the heights there as we get into, you know, later into this summer and into fall. So I think, again, we continue that optimism as far as the box beef trade.
But it's hard to have demand if you don't have supply. Kim Brackett is an Idaho cattlewoman.
My husband and I, we have 4 kids, and we are cow-calf producers in southern Idaho. That's been a lot of fun. They're mostly teenagers now, so I'm getting a lot of work out of them, which has made the past 15 years definitely worthwhile. I've done different leadership roles in the industry, most recently part of the Beef Industry Long Range Plan Task Force, which I really enjoyed. That was a wonderful experience. I'm currently president-elect of the Idaho Cattle Association.
Recently, she had an opportunity to testify before Congress.
I looked at it as an opportunity to reach across that divide once again. We have such a divide between rural America and urban decision makers. And I just looked at it as another chance for me to reach across, bridge that gap, and talk about what we do on our ranch and what sustainability is for me personally and for the industry at large. I think having a rancher's perspective was really beneficial during that committee meeting.
And what did she offer to lawmakers?
It was great. The questions were wonderful. And I hope that I left them understanding that there is a lot of sustainability work being done on America's farms and ranches, already being done, that being solution-minded, we can collaborate and focus on solutions for this, but regulations are not the answer. So that's what I tried to leave them with and hope that was the overall impression. Like I said, I tried to make it personal. So I gave several examples of what we do on our ranch that are sustainability practices. I talked about targeted grazing. We run on federal lands here in Southern Idaho. We have private lands and federal lands. So I talked a lot about how we use targeted grazing as a tool, specifically to reduce fuel loads. We want to avoid those massive wildfires. We've had those. Those are terrible experiences. So being able to reduce fuel loads through grazing. And we also use grazing as a way to combat invasive annual grasses. That's a key role for us here in the Great Basin area. I talked about how grazing contributes to carbon sequestration and that the key role of U.S. farms and ranches, the role that they do play in protecting our country's legacy carbon sinks, really try to underscore the importance of keeping farms and ranches intact. Another area that I talked about is the role that we play in safeguarding wildlife habitats. You know, that could be migratory corridors, that could be flyways. And to bring that point home from a personal perspective, I talked about the pipeline system that we have on our ranch. We developed that to bring water from the mountains down across our high desert country, which was a great thing for the ranch. We're able to run cattle in areas that we couldn't previously due to lack of water. But that, of course, led to increased wildlife populations, from increase in birds to larger big game habitat in that area. Essentially, I think my main point was trying to say that the climate battle needs cattle and not regulations.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
One thing I'm a big advocate of is that the economics, in this case, we're really talking finances, right? So return on investment or the debt coverage ratio. Finances are a backward-looking view into a business.
Brady Brewer is an assistant professor of ag economics at Purdue.
What you see on your balance sheet, your income statements, when you take them to your lender, when you prepare your taxes, right? That is the result of all of those actions that David and Danny are talking about that you did throughout the previous year. Okay, I typically say finances and economics are never a solution. They only lead to better questions. Why did this happen, right? Maybe you changed a production practice, and that led to a higher yield, but maybe cost went up. You're going to see that as a result at the end of the year. Maybe it went down, right? You didn't see the progress, and you didn't work towards the goals you were set for your farm that year, right? Then you need to be asking, why did this happen, right? Finances, by nature, are just backward-looking. And it's our job as good farm managers to make those forward-looking, with the agronomics.
So what would an example of this look like?
Maybe you wanted to increase inputs, right? You applied an input such as a fungicide that you hadn't done previously. Maybe you saw your margins go down, right? There could be a multitude of reasons that your margins went down. It may not have been the fungicide that was the cause of that, right? Mm-hmm. So saying, okay, these environmental factors, maybe it was climate, maybe it was rainfall, right? We have a lot of variability in agriculture. Being able to say, hey, I applied fungicide, it went down, but I'm still going to do it because, okay, 9 times out of 10, we're going to see these climate factors happen, and it's going to protect me into the future. Right, so this is what I expect to happen. Having that plan at the beginning of the year, okay, that plan is really that forward-looking view, okay. Not just saying what happened last year is going to happen again. So I applied fungicide, so therefore I'm not going to do it. Right, set that plan and stick to it.
Danny Morris is an ag economist at the University of Tennessee at Martin.
I think a lot of producers are chasing after higher yields because they have to. I know working with producers in our area, the producers that I would say are top tier, they are multi-generational farms. They are very profitable. The reason why they're very profitable is the yield is there. You know, there's a common phrase in economics, well, you can't out-yield the board trade, but it sure does help. It sure does help to have more revenues going through your farm, and it does come at a cost. But When we would bring in, I know for the last couple of years I was at Extension, we'd bring in Texas A&M and we would do a farmer roundtable discussion about, well, what do you spend on the crop, what's your profitability? And the producers that we brought in that were the highest performing from a financial standpoint, their yields were off the charts. They had figured out the fungicide in the wheat, I got to do it on every acre. It's very beneficial. Fertility is key. I have got to push my corn crop. I have got to push my cotton crop. And in some cases, I know us at UT, we're a little bit behind the times because when we would do a field show and we would put up a budget on the presentation, a farmer would look at you and say, you've got 900 average pound cotton up there. You can't make money unless it's 1,100 pound. And they're right. They're correct. I have got to have that high yield to make money. I know for me on my farm, I've got to have a 1,400 pound steer to sell to my customer to make money. I have got to have that pounds of beef sold. Take it to a row crop example. You got to have those bushels. You got to have that pounds of cotton. You've got to have that high yield to cash flow at the level they need to work 8,000, 10,000 acres of production. And they're smart. Those farmers are business owners. They're highly intelligent, and they figured that out. They know the economics of these applications. And that's the reason why they chase those yields, because it does make them more money in their pocket.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Particularly for soybeans. Again, we see that soybeans, since the, I will kind of preface things in the context of the March 7th run up. You know, that's when prices shot so high for the markets. And soybeans had gotten up to about 1750. That would be the May contract. Came back the day after that on the 8th and dropped down to about 1575.
Kansas State grain economist Dr. Dan O'Brien.
Since that time, have gotten down as low, back down again to the same low, and just within the last day or so, gotten up to 1748. So, yeah, there's a lot of volatility, a lot of movement within a 1575 to 1750 range, but still it does seem like that if we trade above that or below that, that would be something different than what's been happening since early March. And here yesterday, May closed, as we talked about, at the high since that time of 1748 and a quarter. For corn, we had jumped up actually with the movement now above $8 for corn. Again, yesterday's close, 799 and a half, and that was down 16 cents from 8 plus the day before. Again, on March the 7th, we had jumped up to about 780, something like that, and traded down as low as about 715. Well, in the last week, we've moved a lot higher than that range of about 780 and closed up as high as 825, and now I've moved to the lower side. In fact, now we're, as you and I were talking about before we came on air, we have cash prices for corn now and across the state at Colby at 805, Garden City at 850. So positive basis for both of those. Topeka at the top bid, 815, 803 at Hutchinson, 795 at Columbus, 775 in Salina. And that's on a day when the May lead futures were down 16 cents. So $8 cash corn, a lot of locations across the state, something that we would have been surprised to have seen. I should add in also that new crop bids for corn are also doing tremendous fit at these places that we've been watching, really a range on the low side of 714 in Columbus to a high side of 769 in Garden City. And the ratio of new crop corn bids to soybean bids, again, it's figured by having beans over corn on that. All those ratios, well, in western Kansas and Garden City, Colby, it's below two. So strong impetus to trying to encourage corn acres to be planted, especially in Kansas where we have such a use for it, but really not a lot of weakness elsewhere. You see a 205 range with Salina bids, 2.02 in Hutchinson, Columbus, 2.05, Topeka at 2.09, and generally we think 2.25, 2.3 is neutral. So as Kansas votes, the elevators are seeking to encourage new crop corn acres, it sure seems.
Now, O'Brien moves from just the grain markets being range-bound to the strength in ethanol.
Sounds like we're beating the drum for Kansas today, which is not a bad thing to do, but we have the highest range of corn bids at ethanol plants reported on yesterday's markets. Our range in Kansas from 835 and three quarters to 860. Bids at the plants ranges from a 20 over the May contract to 50 over the July. So we do have some straddling going on of contracts in terms of what the cash bids are. And that compares to a range, say, in Illinois, probably the next closest is about 798 to 851. and Nebraska 784 to 830. So given the ethanol plants that we have, and in particular the livestock feeding operations, we've got strongest cash corn market in the United States.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The topsoil moisture picture this week shows things moving in opposite directions.
We saw increases in both topsoil moisture very short to short and topsoil moisture surplus. So what that means is some of the wet areas are getting wetter, but the dry areas are getting drier.
That was USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
If you break the country right in half and look at the Mississippi Valley eastward, a lot of those areas are getting wetter, but from the Pacific Coast to the Great Plains, we're seeing some of those areas getting drier. Now, the exception being the north, we have seen some beneficial moisture from the Pacific Northwest to the Northern Plains, but as you move to the south, some of those drier areas continuing to get drier.
These trends are reflected in the national topsoil moisture numbers for the week ending April 17th.
Very short to short, 36% this week. That's up 1 percentage point from the previous week. And the national surplus topsoil moisture number is 16%. That is also up 1%.
This is Stephanie Hope in Washington, D.C.